as far as I never saw the man stagger.
Question I'd like to ask both of you. I really would. Did you guys know at the time you were playing with him how good he was?
Oh, yeah. Of course. Sure.
No question about that.
There was no question about his genius from the time he first started. You know, as soon as he came, when he landed in Detroit, was 24, somewhere around that, the first time. And then he went on and came on permanently in 26. His genius, his quality had been established, even though it developed.
Oh, yeah.
It developed later, it grew. But it was very short. It meteoric and came quickly. But I want to say one thing. He wasn't so unusual as a drinker. You know, the honest truth is that Bix was in a field where there were quite a number of drunks. I know Bill's no teetotaler, nor am I, but... nor were we drunks, nor are we drunks. But there were plenty others that were at that same time. And so he didn't stand out as the one person who was a drinker. He was easy to find companion.
We all drank, up to a point. But I, in those days, I couldn't drink too much because I'd wake up in the morning with an awful hangover and headache and what he was doing on his instrument. And his ideas that he had, the things he played, and we respected him for that.
You must remember he was playing with another bunch of very, very talented men, and there was no way for him to fool them.
That's right.
I didn't make the tape, but Bill made the tape. No way to fool them.
We knew what he was doing, and we knew it was good. His ideas were
How was Lenny Hayden?
Lenny Hayden was very talented.
What do you guys think of him?
Very talented boy. Very, very talented. Played wonderful piano. Yeah. Some of your responsibilities?
What was he like?
Well, Lenny was a kid. I mean, he was a young kid when he joined Whiteman. He was a young guy.
Who ran those sessions, the Bix and his gang session.
But did you win? We all did. I mean, we were a group.
Did somebody go 1, 2, 3, 4?
Well, sure. If it was Bix's recording date, he'd beat off. 1, 2. He tap his foot, 1, 2, and away we go. That's it. And we started. We played.
They were all head arrangements?
No. Some of the things we had a written introduction and a written ending and a written, maybe a modulation in the middle into a different key or something like that. And then the individual choruses would be in between,
Who did that? Dallas
made some of them, yes.
The little spots? Yes. What, you go through it?
We run over the tune, maybe take us a half an hour to run over the tune and say, well, we do this, we do that, and you take this, you do that, and so forth, and then we make a test record.
Small parts, written parts, and then jam parts.
Play it as you hash it out, and then if it's too long, like I say, then you have to cut it. Then the recorder, he has a stopwatch.
There was no arrangement, but it was as those little pieces, as he said.
That's
right. And there were little prints. And Morgan says, "Don't forget your arrangement, fellas. We're going to practice it at the Biltmore tonight," which we did. And then he had the arranger come in and listen to what the product was, and also listen when the record came out, and we would give the music for it. Then. But by that time, we had memorized it.
Is that the way that the Bix and the Gang was done, or was it a little more formal than that?
You'd have slips of paper. I mean, somebody would write and say, you take this note, that note, and so forth, and you jot them down. And then after everybody jots down their parts on their little strip of paper, then you play it, see if it sounds all right. And if there's a wrong note here or there, well, then you correct it. That's it's with. You see, to the layman, they don't understand all of this. Notes don't mean anything to the layman. They figure, well, all notes are the same or something. Well, they're not. And you see, as you go along the melodic line of a tune, you have different chord changes. And these notes have to be in the chord. And if they're out of the chord, then it's a wrong note. Just like they used to say when I joined the Paramount Studio Orchestra, Victor Young was conductor, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody made a mistake one time. So he said, the blacker the notes and the whiter the paper. Bang.
I'll tell you, along a different line, but those old wax pies, you know, had to be kept in an oven, and they had to be at a certain temperature. If they were too hard, with the needle wouldn't cut it, would flake, and if it was too soft, why, then it would bury. Even though the thing was on a spindle that was running across, but it, you know, it's like trying to make a track in soup or something, water. Well, I was in Europe for a number of years and did a lot of recording in Germany. And they had, like anywhere else, they had an oven that was properly heated. These were done in. But then they brought the wax out into a big auditorium. It was colder than hell, you know. Well, we could play all right. And we couldn't, we weren't able to record that day because they'd start these things off and it was cold enough to chill that wax, and by the time we got down near the end of it, it's like cutting a cake that the frosting has set on the top and it's all goopy inside, and you'd get little cornflakes on the table instead of the ribbon that would wind up on the spindle. We weren't able to accomplish. Compared to today's tapes, it was not an ordeal, but it was a project. You know,
so the end of the recording would end up.
It was all over. It was terribly cold. You know, like 10 below 0, and it wasn't heated with central heating like you have around in here. It was more or less primitive. Those porcelain stones or stoves, what do you call? You know those German stoves that they're little squares like Delft china, all they're made like that. Didn't throw out in the heat.
Speaking about how cold it was. I'll go to the reverse of how hot it was. We made a record in Chicago with Bex and Trombar in a recording studio, and it was in July or August, and it was beastly hot. And I think it was the record where Dior, the drummer, and Trombar were talking about. And the title of the tune, I think, was Take Your Tomorrow. And they did this colored dialogue back and forth. I'll pay you tomorrow and all this business. It was so hot, we took our clothes off and we made the record in our underwear. Believe me,
that's the truth. Of course, there are no women around.
Can we ask you, I think, something a lot of us are interested in, that like all the things you guys did, but what do you have any impression, you know, as we go into this thing about Bix and talking to you guys about Bix, the kind of a guy he was? What do you have any comments you can make? I don't mean to force you into anything. I know that's kind of an awkward comment.
You're not going to force anybody anything that's unpleasant to say about.
Oh, I know it's not. I know it's not a
most darling man, the most gentle fellow, and soft spoken and modest, and almost timid, almost.
Timid, right? Never completely satisfied with his own production.
Well, he played, and if he played something great, I mean, That's right.
Like Bill Rank once said, it took him 20 years to compose in the mix. To his satisfaction. Every time he could find a piano, he was changing a passing period.
Well, maybe so.
I tell you what, Bill Chalice just... Pletcher, I don't know what Pletcher's first name is, but Stu's son. Stu's the father. The boy. He had a copy. He had the folder of Bix's solos. And in the mist was there, And I, when I saw the length of the thing and the amount of writing involved, I asked, Bill was, he and I were sitting together, and Fetch had laid this down on the table. And I said, how long did it take it? How could you ever get it done? And in a mess took six months of collaboration between the two. Now, this was an old soul at that time. And he says, Hal, every time he came in to play it, well, he'd play it, oh, I'd get something down, and he'd say, now take it over up to that point so I can continue, and it wasn't the same thing at all.
No. Every time he could find a piano, he was working at it.
He played a difference. He played just, the notes weren't always the same with him, you know. So that's why it took 6 months to get it in a mist on paper.
I'd like to ask another question.
I'd like to ask a question of both of you.
Make perhaps a tough one, a Fieldon thing. What was your immediate reaction? And in every way, intellectually and logically, when you heard of Bix's death.
Didn't learn about it until later. It was one of those delayed things, as far as I was concerned. And of course, it was upsetting. Because not too long before that, the leader I was running for had been trying to get him across, which of course was fruitless. Nothing materialized from that. But by the time we learned it,
we
were naturally saddened by his untimely death. And, of course, we knew it was inevitable.
Yeah.
Really?
That's the important
part. Of course.
We knew it was inevitable because the guy, when we were on a concert tour, we had to leave him in Cleveland, and Paul got a male nurse for him, and he was there for about 2 weeks. And finally rejoined the band, and he was all right then for a while.
You didn't know how or when, but you knew it was sooner or later.
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
this guy was destroying himself. And
yeah, that's right.
Well, actually,
he was only...
That's a situation...
26 years old?
That's a situation that's existed with a lot of other musicians that are gone, and you knew that ultimately that was going to... the blues was going to get him. Now, writing that very band, Howdy Quishel shortened his life with liquor, and he's gone. And the same for both Dorseys, they overdrank.
Yeah.
The truth is, Fudd Livingston is another, and Murray. And,
of course, liquor didn't kill him, John Murray.
No, but Murray overdrank, and maybe he might not have fallen off. He might have been still alive if he had. He might have been drunk when it happened. I don't know.
Nobody knows.